Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This is our 50th episode, and we've got another milestone to share with you. Sound Optometry has had more than 100,000 listens over the last 5 years. Thank you so much for continuing to support our podcast. This episode is all about diabetic retinopathy, from detection in the community to treatment at the hospital eye service. Diabetic retinopathy is one of the leading causes of blindness among working age people worldwide. But thanks to the Diabetic Eye Screening Programme and a much better understanding of the impact of glycemic control on diabetic retinopathy, we have seen a vast reduction in the level of significant sight loss. In fact, for the first time in 5 decades, diabetic retinopathy is no longer the leading cause of sight impairment registration among working age people in England and Wales. By catching the early signs of disease, eye care practitioners play a vital role in preventing the worst outcomes, such as proliferative retinopathy and diabetic macular edema. Rosie Creer, who presented the recent Docket webinar on the topic, will take us through everything you need to know as an optometrist about the condition.
Within about 20 years of diagnosis, nearly all the patients with type 1 diabetes will have diabetic retinopathy of some kind, and it's around 60% for type 2, and then between about 5 and 10% will develop proliferative diabetic retinopathy.
If you haven't already watched Rosie's webinar, you can find it on the Docket's website. It's called Joining the Dots and Blots of Diabetic Retinopathy. There's also a link in the podcast description. On this podcast, Rosie will also answer some of the questions that you left during her webinar that she didn't have time to address. So let's go ahead and introduce her. In addition to being a webinar superstar, Rosie Creer is the Principal Optometrist for Diabetes at Manchester Royal Eye Hospital. Hi, Rosie. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rosie, to kick us off, why is it so important for optometrists to be able to recognise the signs of diabetic retinopathy in practice?
Well, firstly, it's important to really distinguish the signs that are from diabetic eye disease from other signs on the retina, to be able to establish what the issues are for the patient, or to inform the patient of the state of their diabetic retinopathy if they have it. Because if you are able to know about the signs and the stages of it, then you can inform your patient what their risk of developing further problems or needing treatments are.
And of course, not everybody knows that they're diabetic. So if a patient comes in not knowing that they're diabetic, you need to be able to recognise when you do see potential danger signs so that you can inform the patient and take the appropriate management action.
Absolutely. Quite often the first signs that they're diabetic are eye changes. So it's really important that, you know, you're looking out for that so they can potentially get their diagnosis by having seen these changes at the back of the eye and then the optometrist directing them to the GP for further blood tests or to work out whether that might be what's causing the changes.
I was quite surprised, actually. There's quite a high number of people that don't know they have diabetes and that have retinopathy already when they're diagnosed.
Yes, it's around 1 in 3.
So that is quite surprising. So what are the risks of people with diabetes developing retinopathy?
So within about 20 years of diagnosis, nearly all the patients with type 1 diabetes will have diabetic retinopathy of some kind, and it's around 60% for type 2. And then between about 5 and 10% will develop proliferative diabetic retinopathy.
That's quite a high percentage over the long term.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Having diabetes for that long, you will have some damage to the blood vessels. And then that sort of is shown in the signs for diabetic retinopathy.
So the better control you have from early on, the better the prognosis, really.
Yeah, well, the treatments that we have are actually to treat the problems that have already developed. Rather than try and cure it, they're trying to reduce the risk of them developing further. So actually, if you can prevent that progression onto the advanced problems, that's going to be much more beneficial to the patient than having to do something as destructive as laser or, you know, that type of thing.
In the webinar, quite a few listeners had questions about what affects the severity of retinal changes. So how does diabetes control affect those changes? So is there much correlation between an increase in HbA1c levels and worsening retinopathy?
Absolutely. So if you can decrease your HbA1c by 1%, that will reduce your risk of developing the retinopathy or progression of retinopathy by 34%. So it's a big change that it can have.
Yeah. So quite often in practice, we do ask patients, so how well controlled is your diabetes? And they say, oh yeah, it's great. But you look in their eye and you think, really? So they're not lying. So why is that? Why does that happen?
It's such a complex disease and there's so many different things that can actually affect the blood vessels and the change to the blood vessels. You know, really HbA1c, blood pressure and cholesterol, they're the only things or a few of the things that can be modified. So it could be that the patient's got really good control now, but in the past they've had higher blood sugar levels. So it could be historic hyperglycemia, you know, even before they knew they were diabetic. There's other risk factors, you know, there's lots of other chemical pathways or inflammatory pathways that can be affecting the blood vessels.
So other coexisting pathology or comorbidity can influence the retinopathy as well?
Yeah, things like blood pressure and higher cholesterol levels, absolutely. But yeah, other things can change the microvasculature of the retina as well.
So that brings me on to the next question about medications. Are there any specific medications that increase the risk of retinopathy? I think a couple of listeners were asking about that.
So we were talking in the webinar a bit about the GLP-1 agonists. And actually, they don't particularly worsen the retinopathy directly. But what's happening there is that the rapid reduction in the HbA1c can cause this early worsening effect. So it just means that the retinopathy can progress because the levels change rapidly. So it's not sort of a direct effect of the drug as such. It's that rapid improvement of the blood sugar levels. There is a drug called pioglitazone, which is one medication that can have an impact on macular edema. So that needs to really be taken into account when you're deciding on how to treat the maculopathy.
I see. So in terms of grading and the telltale signs that someone might be heading towards proliferative retinopathy, what are the main diabetic retinal changes seen on fundoscopy, which are due to leakage in the blood vessels?
The mild changes, so when you have mild non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, the signs that you see will be the dot hemorrhages, microaneurysms, just very early signs of the changes. As it progresses, so the more moderate changes, you'll have more of the blot hemorrhages, so the larger hemorrhages. Then when you get to the severe changes, that would then add on things like the intraretinal microvascular anomalies and venous beading and other signs of ischemia, such as cotton wool spots and, I'd say, more of the hemorrhages.
One of the questions that was asked is, how do you tell the difference between an IRMA and a little bit of neovascularization? Do they actually look very different or not?
They can look really different or they can look very similar. It's a really difficult thing to do. If you're looking at an eye itself, sometimes you can see the new vessels, so the neovascularization can stand off the retina a little bit or sort of be a bit more prominent, whereas the IRMA is seen within the retina. But actually, you can have new vessels that look very similar to IRMA. You can have IRMA that look very similar to new vessels. So for some cases, you will need to do further investigation, so either a fluorescein angiogram or OCT angiography, something like that, that will actually be able to tell the difference. It's not always as straightforward. I know people do struggle with that, as I do too, you know.
So IRMAs are a precursor to neovascularization, but with them looking so similar, is it actually important to know which is which in terms of grading classification?
Yes, absolutely. So that's what takes the retinopathy grade from severe non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy to then proliferative diabetic retinopathy.
And actually, if I just go back a step, in terms of the dot or the blot hemorrhages, what's the difference between a dot hemorrhage and a microaneurysm? Because again, that was another question that someone asked. And again, is it important to know the difference?
So a microaneurysm is really these very tiny extensions from the capillary wall. So that's actually the bit that's leaking. And then the dot hemorrhage is the bit that's leaked out of the microaneurysm. In the grand scheme of things, it probably doesn't make any difference. So you don't need to know what the differences are because the hemorrhages are part of the grading scheme because they're a sign of leakage. And we know that they have to leak from somewhere. So, you know, it's not important to know which bit's leaking, which bit's not leaking until you start to think about treating macular edema and things like that. So then that's when you need to know which is the microaneurysm, because when the laser's carried out, that's the bit that you're targeting to prevent the leakage or stop the leakage from happening.
And is that determined by OCT or just by clinical judgment?
OCT can be very helpful. you can see on the OCT often you can see like an oval hyper-reflective shape. And sometimes it's helpful to use other things like fluorescein angiography, and that can show you the point of leakage as well. Sometimes you can see it, and it's, you know, on the actual fundus you can see it, but it is helpful to have those imaging support to kind of work out which bit of the retina that you're targeting for treatment.
And I'm sure all of us have seen the odd dots hemorrhage in a diabetic patient. I thought, yeah, it's not too important. But someone did ask, actually, does it matter if that dot is closer to the macula? Is it more ominous if that dot hemorrhage is near the macula rather than further out?
You can have a dot of hemorrhage, you know, in the far periphery, or you could have one at the macula. And if it's in the far periphery, if it's a microaneurysm and it's leaking, that's much less likely to cause any problem with your sight than if one is right next to the fovea. That's why it's important to see where the fluid is, and if that's got a potential to cause a problem with the sight, then it is obviously going to cause more of a problem.
Yeah, so would that indicate that the patient should be referred to the GP or back to the screening service for further investigation?
Not necessarily. I think it does depend on what the vision's like and whether there's a larger area of leakage. There's quite a lot of different things to consider. One specific microaneurysm may not be an indication to refer somebody. So if they have a microaneurysm within the foveal area, if the vision is reduced to 6/12 or less than that, that was what the referral criteria was. So if you've just got a microaneurysm, it might be that it's not leaking. It might not be causing any problem at all, in which case it wouldn't need any referral.
Yeah, so you do need to check, cross-reference your referral criteria with your clinical findings before making a decision, really.
Yeah.
Just thinking about the macular changes a bit more, if there are changes, what might you see on OCT?
If you do an OCT for a patient who you suspect has macular edema, then you're often going to see microaneurysm, but you could also see different types of fluids. You might have intraretinal fluid. Sometimes you can have subretinal fluid as well, but more often you would see the intraretinal fluid.
And if an optometrist did see this in the community, would that justify an urgent referral to the hospital diabetic service?
No, macular edema is, or clinically significant macular edema is a routine referral normally. It's not an urgent one. If the vision is severely affected, then that's a bit more of a sooner referral rather than a routine one, but it's not classed as an urgent referral.
And we've mentioned the screening programme, and the programme has changed quite recently. So for those people who haven't heard the webinar yet, just briefly, what are the main changes to the screening programme?
So the first one would be about the screening intervals. It used to be that everybody was screened annually within the diabetic screening programme. The changes that have happened are if the person being screened has no diabetic retinopathy, on two subsequent visits, they can then have their interval extended to 24 months, so to 2 years rather than the annual review.
So if a patient is new to the screening programme, they would be seen for a baseline visit, and if there was no retinopathy present, they would still be seen the following year. And then only if there is no retinopathy again, it would then be extended to 2 years.
Yes. And the second change is a change to the digital surveillance programme. So the digital surveillance is part of the screening programme. And that's when people are seen a little bit more often than they would if they're on the routine diabetic screening. So if somebody has signs of diabetic maculopathy or more moderate to severe diabetic retinopathy, they can be seen within the digital surveillance programme. And then they can have the OCT, as well as carrying out more photographs.
So what are those additional photographs?
So the routine diabetic screening would be two separate photographs for each eye. So one that's disc-centred and one that's macular-centred. And if they go through to digital surveillance, they'll have seven fields. So you get a bit of a wider view of the retina and they can be screened from there. So it's about keeping the patients at lower risk of developing diabetic retinopathy in the screening programme, and those with higher risk of changes or needing treatment can then come through to the hospital eye service.
So for those patients where their retinopathy is more severe, so perhaps they've got non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, there were just a couple of questions about that from the webinar. I think the grading system mentions if there are more than 20 hemorrhages in all four quadrants. Is that 20 across the four quadrants combined, or is that 20 in each quadrant? That was one of the questions that was asked.
Yeah, it's in each quadrant. It sounds like a lot, but when you actually look at the pictures, it's not as many as as you think, you know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's got, you quite easily get to 20. That's the sort of the official grading.
Because the mental image in my head is if you had 20 hemorrhages in each quadrant, that really would look very spotty.
Yeah.
And of course, we are looking at risk for progression to severe stage, so you would expect it to look quite noticeable. Okay. And also, you mentioned a phrase, compared to standard photos. What does that mean?
So this is based on a study called the ETDRS study. So it's the Early Treatment for Diabetic Retinopathy study. And in order to work out the gradings, they had these standard photographs, and they're called the Ehrlichhaus photographs. And you can see those from the diabetic screening page on the government website. So they show you, basically, if you think that the retinopathy looks more progressed than that, then you know you're sort of worse than the standard photographs, so you know which category you're into. So you've got that comparison.
Ah, that's interesting.
So it just helps to make it a bit more standard, because it's quite difficult. Things like this sometimes can be quite subjective. But if you've got these standard photographs, it just makes it that much easier.
Yeah, it just gives you a benchmark to compare it to.
Exactly.
And in terms of risk of progression to proliferative retinopathy, it's much higher once someone is at this stage, isn't it?
Yes. So if somebody has moderate non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, they have only 11% chance of developing proliferative diabetic retinopathy within a year. So that's why they're able to keep them within the screening service, because they're at much lower risk. Whereas then when the patient develops severe non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, that risk goes up to 54%.
So it's a big jump, and that's the point that they go into the diabetic service within the hospital eye service.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, so they can be monitored a bit more regularly, so that if any small signs or early stages of proliferative diabetic retinopathy are spotted, then treatment can start.
Moving on to examining diabetic patients in routine community practice. Again, there was a lot of questions around this. Would a patient still be expected to have a 12 monthly eye examination if they're on the diabetic screening programme?
I would have a look at the College of Optometrists recommendations for this. So if the patient's attending screening, then they shouldn't necessarily need that 12-month eye exam. It should be based on what they would have if they weren't diabetic, as long as they are attending the screening programme. So if they're not in the screening programme, you could then offer them dilation and the examination, but you can't class it as screening, because the screening program have very specific and very rigorous quality assurance standards that they have to meet. So if you're doing an eye exam as a standard eye exam, then you can carry it out as normal, looking out for anything, obviously, that if you were concerned about, but it wouldn't be classed as screening, but you would follow your normal clinical pathway.
And does being in the surveillance arm mean that they don't need an OCT either if they do attend for a normal eye examination, and do they still need to be dilated?
So they shouldn't need to be dilated if they're attending the screening programme, because they'll have the dilation and exam done there. The OCT exam is it's a difficult one to answer, really, because I think you should do your OCT based on your clinical judgment. And there's no sort of definite requirement to do an OCT as part of the eye exam. So that's where it gets a little bit of a difficult one to sort of generalise. I would say if you feel that the patient needs an OCT, you do an OCT and you go on your judgment from there.
I'd agree with that. And if someone is under active management with the hospital eye service but attends for an eye examination during that period, is it appropriate to prescribe spectacles? I mean, I imagine it would be, but it was a question that was asked.
Again, it's a bit of a tricky one, because I think you want to make sure that the patient is stable, because you don't want the patient to go back having to change their glasses and such. But I think if the patient is having ongoing treatment, but things are fairly stable or relatively stable for them, for example, they're having anti-VEGF injections, if they've had their first three, for example, even if they're still having active treatment, it probably won't change the prescription hugely after that point. And what you want for them is to actually see the best they can. So for me, I would say as long as they're not at a really early stage of treatment, or they're not just about to have surgery or something like that, there's no reason why not to prescribe them spectacles if their vision's going to improve. They're going to benefit from having a different pair of glasses. I think it's important that they get the optimal vision that they can have at that point.
And we are going to be seeing patients quite often in between screening visits, and we might see some changes and we're not sure whether or not we should refer them. So from your point of view, what would warrant a referral to the hospital, even if they're already on a screening programme? What changes would justify that referral?
If you see a patient, I think it's important to check when their next screening appointment is, because I think that can probably help you out a little bit, because it is difficult. There's always going to be things that you spot that you don't know whether someone else has spotted it. You're going to have to use your clinical judgment, really. I think if somebody has been for screening, but it was 11 months ago and you're seeing something that's concerning you or going to cause a problem with the vision, then you probably do need to refer it on. And then if the hospital say, actually, they're already under our care for this, or, you know, maybe they need to go back to the screening service. It's very difficult. Some places will do things very differently, you see. So I don't want to sort of generalize again too much. But I think if you're seeing any proliferative changes, you definitely need to refer and not rely on sort of hoping that they're going to be picked up next time, because you don't know when that next time will necessarily be. The College of Optometrists guidance suggests that you should inform the care provider. So it just depends on who they're under and what it is that you're seeing, really.
And would that be urgent referral, do you think?
For proliferative changes, yes.
And what about maculopathy? What degree of maculopathy would need to be referred?
It's normally a routine referral. Mm. Again, if it's something you're really concerned about, the vision's really changed or something, you can write that in the referral letter to flag that to the people you're referring to.
Because otherwise it would be routine. And actually, one listener did ask, if someone has got one or two small intraretinal cysts, but there's no significant increase in the macular thickness and the vision seems unaffected, does that need referring, or can you just leave that to be monitored under the screening program?
I think that's the type of thing that's staying in the screening program. But for those types of cases, it might be worth potentially inform the screening program that maybe they'd want to see them a bit sooner if you feel that there's something that's sort of a bit in between, you know. Again, it's difficult because it'll be different within each areas, but that's the type of thing that doesn't need treatment as such.
If a patient is not attending screening or has fallen by the wayside of the screening program, how can you get that person back on track?
Inform the GP. The GP will be able to register them with their local screening program and get them back in.
So moving on, let's talk about the hospital eye service and the treatments that are potentially available there. What goes into the decision to treat someone with proliferative diabetic retinopathy? What things do you consider?
For treatment for proliferative diabetic retinopathy, you want to have evidence that there's new blood vessels. And there will be some variations across different consultants who make the decisions about these treatments. Generally, if there's any signs of proliferative diabetic retinopathy, the NICE guidance suggests that you should start laser treatment, so pan-retinal photocoagulation, as soon as you see the new blood vessels.
And are there any other treatments apart from laser?
Yes, I mean, there's an option for anti-VEGF treatment, but that's not first-line treatment, and pan-retinal photocoagulation would always be first-line for treatment.
What about for diabetic macular edema? What would be the treatment for that?
So it depends on what type of macular edema it is. So if it is centre-involving diabetic macular edema, then anti-VEGF injections would be your first-line treatment. So that would be that it's affecting the vision and the thickness of the retina is sufficient to really want to start anti-VEGF treatment. The previous NICE guidance suggested it was over 400 microns that you'd start treatment for that. But the newer NICE guidance suggests it can be less than that as long as it's centre involving and affecting the vision. But it would have to go down to local protocols on that one.
So you mentioned that that's first line treatment. What about topical intervention prior to that? Is there any consideration given to topical therapy first, or is that not effective enough?
Not really. If you're suspecting it's due to something else, then there's other topical treatments. But generally, diabetic macular edema, you would sort of, you know, if you're going to treat it, then anti-VEGF is normally the one. If it's not centre-involving, then you would consider macular laser. But identifying your microaneurysms or areas of exudation is important. But that would tend to be non-centre-involving that you would do macular laser.
And just thinking about the future, are there any new treatments on the horizon at all?
There'll always be new anti-VEGFs. Trials are always trying to improve things, and there's other treatments that are already on the market, like steroid implants and things. So there's always something new coming.
But I guess it's waiting for the trials to be done and for NICE to approve before we will see it in the mainstream NHS service.
Absolutely, yeah.
So just to finish off, in your view, what is the most important thing that optometrists can do for their diabetic patients?
The key things for me would be not so much in the how I would assess the actual fundus, but I think it's really about making sure that you know about the patient's diabetes itself. So how long have they been diabetic? What type of diabetes they have? What do they know about their blood sugar levels? Are they getting them tested? Are they under the GP, are they under a specialist? Just having that information about their background to try and engage the patient to make sure that they are aware of what's happening with their diabetes and their general health, things like the blood pressure, cholesterol level. Even if they say they don't know, if they get used to sort of somebody asking them about it, then maybe they could then understand, you know, having had a discussion with you about why you're asking them and the potential implications of that on their eyes. I think that's an important discussion to have.
And it does take some skill having those conversations, because some people can understandably feel defensive. It's never easy living with a chronic condition after all.
Yes. You know, we're not trying to sort of tell them off or judge them, because none of this is very easy for anybody. Mm. And sometimes they're doing all the best things that they can to improve things, but without much success, or they're needing support. So identifying that kind of support is also useful. But I think it's important that they engage with it and understand why we're asking, and also being able to show them what the changes are. If you've got a fundus camera, or if you even describe to them what you're seeing, is really important. Because as I said, you know, in the webinar, that actually if we can reduce the risk of progression at an early stage, then that might be really helpful for them later down the line. So I would make sure I had those conversations, as well as, you know, obviously doing the standard stuff, looking at the eye itself and ensuring that I know what stage of retinopathy or maculopathy that I can see, to get that engagement to help them in the future.
Rosie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
During Rosie's webinar, a lot of you asked questions from different parts of the country about what the diabetic retinopathy grading is in your area, as the specifics can vary. The best way to look at this information is to go to your nation's public health websites and read through the information. We've put some links in the podcast description to get you started, and in the additional reading materials for this episode on the Docket website. Finally, diabetic retinopathy is, of course, a topic we've covered on Sound Optometry before. In episode 31, we walked through exactly how the diabetic eye screening programme works. We also examined how artificial intelligence is beginning to play a role in detecting retinal changes. So the bots could soon be coming to a screening service near you.
If you were able to turn up to your diabetic eye screening appointment, and instead of waiting weeks or months for the answer about, will I go blind, the AI technology potentially could give you that answer within seconds of having the photograph taken. From a clinician point of view, looking for subtle things like microaneurysms, it's pretty well known that ophthalmologists are pretty bad at finding that single microaneurysm compared with either the AI technology or professional graders. For health service, for the NHS, introducing these technologies could potentially save time.
I would highly recommend that you scroll back to episode 31 of Sound Optometry to hear more. That's all from us this month. Thanks for listening. Don't forget that if you head to dockets.info and search for Sound Optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. Remember that if you've listened to this podcast and go on to complete the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering communication and clinical practice. We'll be back again next month with our 51st episode, which will be about brain tumours. So make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss out. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.